Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. We got a little bit of a late start today because we have two guests joining us from Mexico City that were having a little trouble getting into the conference, so we were facilitating that. I'm Barbara Fields, Executive Director of Association for Global New Thought and co-director of the upcoming Awaken World 2012 conference, getting closer and more real by the day, and I'm here with my colleague and co-director, Jim Kenney.
Hi.
Some of us, you're probably some of us, like some of you, we're both in semi-vacation mode. We're trying to work. I, at the same time that I've got my family visiting from Beijing with a five-year-old, which is delightful, but it's kind of hard to stare at the computer with a five-year-old around. And Jim, you're visiting family in where?
We're in Connecticut on our way to Maine to visit our son and daughter-in-law and two of our grandkids. So it's great.
Right. So I welcome you all here today, and I hope you're having a good summer and doing things with your family or just doing things that are fun for you. So let's get started today. I don't think I need to talk very much about the background of the tutorials anymore because I see that all of you who are here today on the call, there are many people not here today because they're traveling or on vacation. But those of you who are here, most of you have been on the calls before as far as I can see. Has anyone not been on one of the tutorials? And the way you can let me know is you can raise your hand, quote unquote, by pressing 1 on your telephone keypad. I think I've seen... Oh, of course. Reverend Patrick McCollum is with us, and Ginny Bidding is with us. We'll maybe get together in groups.
And Kiki Bill.
Oh, and Kiki. Hi. Welcome.
Hi, thanks.
And I might say also, Megan, if you could give microphones to Ginny and Patrick, I'd like them to say hi to the group. Ginny?
Hi there. I haven't been on the calls, but I have listened to every single one, so I'm excited to be here tonight.
Thank you.
Oh, that's...
And Patrick, welcome. How are you doing?
Very well, and I haven't been on the calls either, but I'm finally excited to get on them, and I'm looking forward to hearing what you all have to say.
Great. And Kiki, did you want to just do a quick hello? Because you haven't been on one of our calls before either.
Hello. I, too, am looking forward to hearing everything that's going on tonight. Thanks very much.
Great. So today, our general tutorial topic is service towards human rights and social justice. And in the tutorial, we've looked at the two spiritual traditions, Hinduism and Sikhism. It's our fifth tutorial, and so we've covered several others in the previous ones. We had audio interviews and readings today from interviews with K.L. Seshagiri, Giri Rao, and Dr. Paul Nitter. And the global manifesto that we looked at was the UN Millennium Development Goals. So normally what we do in this moment is ask for one of our participants, because we really like that this is a conversation and a dialogue, to lead us all in just a moment of centering meditation or centering prayer just to bring us all into the space and away from our busy days. And I wonder if we might have a volunteer to do that for us. You can indicate by pressing 1 on your telephone keypad. It's not getting volunteers. I might have to surprise somebody by calling on them. Oh, a brave soul, a dear one too, Reverend Michael Bernard. Would you like to lead us today?
Certainly. Am I on?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we can.
Good. And so we just take this moment together to just breathe in concert, breathing deeply, centering ourselves in the oneness, knowing that all is well and that all that is shared here today is coming from the heart of the one. And so we just breathe into this compassionate service space that we create, that we enjoy, knowing that It is the one life, the one power, the one presence. It is love, it is compassion coming forward from us, from our speakers, from our readers. It is well. I'm grateful for this time together. I bless it and name it exceedingly good. Name it an activity in the mind of God. I simply let go. I release it. Knowing it is so, in agreement, we simply say, and so, amen.
Amen.
Amen. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. One of the things that we like to do now, since we have the capability of putting ourselves into smaller groups, is part of our community building exercise. I'm hopeful that many of you will start to know one another a little bit before we actually get to Rome. And these short introductions in small groups seem to facilitate that. So I think that we'll go into small groups as we have in the past and just introduce yourself quickly to each other by name. We won't facilitate it because you can figure it out. It's simple. And then take, just each of you take, I would say, 2 minutes or so. We might ring a bell to give you some guidelines about timing. But do say a little bit about whatever is most on top for you right now. And that actually could be anything because it's been a busy week on all levels in the news and in our lives and everything else. So just take a few minutes and introduce yourselves and then go around and say a little bit about that. And we'll, when we're all done, we'll get back into the heart of our conversation today. So let's begin now.
You are now in a breakout. Please begin.
So we are back. Is that right, Megan? Are we here?
We are.
Okay. Great. So I hope that was an enjoyable and meaningful experience for everyone. And now we're going to get into the part of our tutorial where we do a thumbnail on a couple of the religious traditions that will be represented in Rome and Florence. Many of you are very familiar with the various religious history, and some of you are not familiar with it, and all levels are just fine, but we're going to ask our resident expert, Jim Kenny, to tell us a little bit about the basics of each of these traditions. So, my friend Jim, take it away.
Hi. The two traditions we're talking about tonight are Hinduism and Sikhism, and normally what we do is, and we've provided all this material on the website, and I'm sure all of you are familiar with it, and most all of you have taken a look at it. For each religion that's listed in our resource place there, we have a very short summary, and then a brief description of the excellence of that tradition, and that grows out of a wonderful notion that came to my attention through the late Swiss scholar of religions, Fritjof Schuon, who wrote a wonderful book that I keep mentioning every time because I think everyone should be familiar with it. It's called The Transcendent Unity of Religions. And in that book, which he wrote, I believe it was published in 1976, he says, every religion is superior to every other by virtue of something it does best. So under each tradition, we've supplied an idea of what the excellence of that tradition might be, an example of the master story of that tradition. It's the story it most wants to tell and teach, an example of a classic central religious pattern and an ethical norm. And because of what happened at the Sikh Gurdwara, and Gurdwara, Gurdwara, is the actual word that you've been seeing in the newspapers as temple. Temple is really not appropriate, but at the Sikh Gurdwara in Milwaukee, because of that terrible tragedy, I thought instead of going through all of those different parts as we've been doing in the past weeks, I'd just say that for both of these traditions, I'd like to talk about them together in a sense. And then say a little bit more about Sikhism, because that's the tradition that's probably less familiar to most of us, and especially since it's been in the news, I think it's important to talk about it after this awful thing. And Hinduism and Sikhism are both Indian traditions. along with Buddhism and Jainism, native traditions of India. And those four religions, Hinduism, and then Buddhism and Jainism, arising a little bit later in the 15th and 16th century, Sikhism, they share a number of essential elements. They share the belief that humans are essentially divine, but have in one way or another forgotten about that, and need to recall or remember or relearn or rediscover that. And each of the four traditions, again, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, and Sikhism, each of those four traditions talks about enlightenment, which is that process of rediscovering that I am somehow divine or intimate with the divine. Each of the four traditions talks about something that we might speak of in general terms as meditation or contemplation. Each certainly talks, each in its own way and in very unique ways and very differently, each one talks about rebirth or reincarnation. So they have all of that in common. Now, what's interesting is that there has been, between Sikhism and Hinduism, there has always been a certain tension. And that tension, it's not unlike the tension that has existed at times between Judaism and Christianity. Sikhism originally was born as a, in part at least, as a critique. It was a revelation in its own regard, but it had strong elements of critique of Hinduism as it was practiced. In particular, the Sikh tradition, and this is really relevant to our general topic tonight of service and social justice and so on, the Sikh tradition was powerfully critical of the Hindu tradition of the caste system. And so the idea that no one should be the servant or the inferior of any other, that we were all equal in the sight of God. And one of the remarkable things about the Sikh tradition, and I think if you followed the story of the awful thing that happened in Milwaukee, you probably got a sense at least that women in that community had roles that were as important as the roles of some of the men in the community, and that's something that Sikhism has always prided itself on, that women are also leaders of the community. But I should also add that there's another element of the Sikh tradition. It was always an oppressed tradition, and so it developed a very strong warrior motif. And every Sikh male has, at least traditionally, not all are observant in this regard, but every Sikh male is invited, if fully devoted and observant, is invited to bear five marks of his identity as a servant of the holy order of Sikhism. And those marks are the long hair, which is never cut, which is worn under the turban, a comb that is always there as a sign of discipline. Twice a day the hair is combed, and it must never be tangled and always clean and glistening and so on, and that's a sign of, it's a symbol of the kind of discipline to the divine. Each one wears a bracelet that symbolizes membership in the Sikh order. There are undergarments, traditional undergarments that symbolize purity. But very interesting is that every Sikh male who is observant is to carry a dagger on his person. I remember, and Barbara will remember, at the 1993 Parliament of the World's Religions in Chicago, there were a couple of occasions where there was difficulty with security, because some of the very high-ranking leaders of the community don't carry daggers; they carry huge silver swords. Some of the security people at the center where we held the event didn't think that was appropriate. So this is a very a long tradition of militancy, and Sikhs became the famous Gurkha regiments of the British Army in India. Fierce fighters and so on. And yet, after this massacre that took place at the temple in Milwaukee, what I was most struck by is how many people who spoke up said, we're not angry, we don't want vengeance, we just want to understand what's going on, why does this happen, and what can we do to help it to stop. So I thought that was remarkable. I spoke a little bit about the tension between the two traditions and a symbol. This is just sort of interesting, an interesting fact for those of us who collect interesting facts about interreligious experience. Swami Vivekananda, who spoke at the 1893 Parliament of the World's Religions and who has become a sort of symbol of interreligious dialogue and interreligious understanding, is not terribly beloved of Sikhs, and the reason for that is that at that 1893 Parliament in Chicago, he spoke of his great affection for Sikhism and his love of Sikhism as a sort of slightly off form of Hinduism. And Sikhs have never quite gotten over that. But in any case, these two traditions are traditions that are exemplary in one other regard. And when we talk about the interview with Dr. Seshagiri Rao, who is the editor of the Encyclopedia of Hinduism, he had some things to add to our notes about the excellence of Hinduism. He wanted to talk about service. And both Sikhs and Hindus would use the same Sanskrit word for service, and it's seva, S-E-V-A, simply means service, and it means service to others, compassionate service to those in need, and essentially it means spiritually motivated social engagement, which is the overarching theme, thanks to the insight of Barbara Fields, the overarching theme of this conference. And for Hindus and for Sikhs, this is an absolutely central idea, that the test of one's insight, the test of one's growth toward the divine, is how one carries that energy out in service, compassionate service to those in need. So those are a few of the things that are on my mind. I should mention just as another fact that Sikhs, we don't know yet the story of this skinhead fella who carried out the attack, but there's a strong suspicion that he thought that these people, since they wore turbans, were probably Muslims. And Sikhs all over the United States, well, in a number of separate incidents, have been attacked by people on the angry far right who believed that since they wore turbans, they must be Muslims.
I think that's ironic, because it's almost like, oops, we exhibited a hate crime by mistake. We meant to hate the other religion. You know, it's actually, and many of the people that I've been talking to about that incident have been understanding the specific gravity of what happened this time to the Sikh community, but almost without exception, people are noting it happened to the Sikhs this time. And I don't remember really hearing people have the expectation that people would be so violently persecuted for having a different belief system. And now it's become an expectable or a norm in our society. And I've had some wonderful conversations with people coming to the conference and new registrants for the conference in the last few days, who are very inspired by the fact that we're looking for a true, concrete form of engagement with these issues, that it's not okay to say, isn't it terrible that this happened? It's only okay to say, we have to make it our personal responsibility in our own way, shape, or form to contribute to a solution so that it won't keep happening to whichever community is next. And I think that's extremely important, and that we do have something to say about that. We are not powerless in this regard. I think, you know, this might be a good chance to ask people participating on the call if they have any questions at all that Jim can answer, because he's got such a wide breadth of knowledge, or any comments that they would like to make before we go forward. Okay, good. Then let's just proceed. Let's go to the first interview with Professor Paul Nitter, who's been a long, I know Paul somewhat, and have worked with him in the past, but he's quite a good friend of Jim's, and maybe, Jim, you could tell us a little bit more about Paul Nitter and a little bit of, just start talking about the interview.
Sure. First of all, I think everyone on the call is familiar with the fact that many of the religious leaders, in a sense, the core of what we're calling the core group of religious and spiritual leaders at the conference, are members of an organization called the International Interreligious Peace Council that was formed after the 1993 Parliament of the World's Religions. And the idea was to bring together about 20 or so very prominent religious leaders and help them to build personal relationships and then to visit places around the world where there were conflict situations or difficulties of that sort, and where their compassion, their kindness, their attention, and in a sense their moral authority might make a difference. And the Peace Council was formed back in 1995. And Paul Nitter and I are both trustees of the Peace Council. We have another trustee of the Peace Council on the line, Miguel Alvarez, and also a former trustee who's now a Peace Counselor, Father Gonzalo Ituarte, who's the head of the Dominican Order in Mexico. And, of course, both Miguel and Gonzalo know Paul Nitter very well. Paul is a remarkable, remarkable person. He is, I would say, without hesitation, he is the American theologian scholar of pluralism. Pluralism, of course, we all are familiar with what exclusivism is, the idea that if my religion is true, yours must be false. And then there's inclusivism, which is a much more generous point of view that says, well, my religion is truer than yours. Yours is true enough that it's deserving of my respect. And then there's pluralism. And pluralism is the view that more than one religion can be fully viable and fully authentic, and that religions complement one another. And Paul Nitter is the most articulate advocate of that position that I know. And so I've just chosen a couple of elements from the interview that we conducted a couple of years ago, Barbara and I conducted with Paul. And at that time I asked him, why is interreligious engagement so important? And he answered on two levels. He answered on the religious level and also on the moral level. And I love his response on the religious level. Why is interreligious engagement so important? And he says, God is too big to fit into any one religion. I love that line. It's sort of a sister line to the earlier one I cited from Fritjof Schuon, S-C-H-U-O-N, by the way, that every religion is superior to every other by virtue of something it does best. But Paul says the truth that religious people have experienced, however it is termed, is always more than any human being can grasp. Each of us can share the truth that we know so that all of us can grow in the truth we do not yet have. And another beautiful line, people engaged in dialogue find that their grasp of truth or of God is both intensified in what they already have and expanded into what they do not yet have. And then he also spoke about the importance of interreligious engagement. I love this too, on the moral level. He said, on the moral level, we're becoming aware more and more of two challenges. The first is to appreciate how different we are in terms of our ethnic, our religious backgrounds, and so on, and our experiences. And yet, we are beginning to realize that those differences have to be the materials out of which we can build greater community. So out of diversity comes deeper, richer, greater harmony and community. And then he says, differences are the building blocks of unity. And if they are not, they'll become the springboards of conflict.
That's amazing.
By the way, he mentioned a third, which is the political level. And I think these first two are even more important. But on the political level, he quotes Jonathan Sacks, who is the chief rabbi, the Orthodox chief rabbi of Great Britain, who says if religions are not part of the solution, they will continue to be part of the problem. And of course, that reminds us of the great Swiss theologian Hans Küng, who was the principal author of one of our global declarations towards a global ethic. And Hans Küng wrote and proclaims constantly, there will be no peace among the nations until there is peace among the religions. And this is what Paul Nitter has devoted his life to making real. And Paul will be joining us in Rome and Florence, and he's really looking forward to it.
Yeah, we'll be very glad to see him again and see what he has to offer to this conversation, because without a doubt, all of the people in our core group, I would say all the people in our activist group as well, are characterized by something that strikes me as a very good quality for this kind of discussion. People who are interested in learning more and willing to not be attached to their pre-existing conditions. In this case, that there's so many people who are devoted to the greater understanding. In fact, the evolution of religion and spirituality in the 21st century, which is another big piece of our discussion in Italy. Religion and spirituality themselves are evolving, and it would be better for us to have a conversation about that that's explicit, so that we can apply what we learn to developing new models for the way that we conduct ourselves as religious and spiritual communities in the future that may not have been necessary or appropriate in the past. There's another part of the interview that was conducted with Paul Nitter that had to do with the Global Commons. And of course, please, anyone who wants to interject a comment at any time, feel free to raise your hand. But Paul had said that there are a lot of things that belong to all of us, and we can each of us flourish only when all of us share these things, which reminded me immediately of the notion of Ubuntu, the South African term that does express the diversity and the fact that we all carry a certain richness in our traditions that are a piece of the puzzle, and that we are all enriched by understanding other pieces. And I'm sure that if we look not even very hard, we would see a similar term that's celebrated in every tradition.
That reminds me of one other great line in the interview when he says, what's pluralism? And he says, a person is a pluralist when he or she recognizes that it is essential for the human project to recognize that every one of us has a very important word to speak, but that none of us has the final word to speak.
Hmm. Yeah.
Cool.
And Paul speaks a lot about that there's a kind of, that there's a fundamental conviction in all of the religions that's expressed in different forms, but that there is something that is the source or the ground of all of us, whatever we call it, whatever symbol or language we use to describe it. So he says, in a sense, we're all commoners and part of that shared reality, that shared field or shared ground. And that he goes on to say that the commonness of ultimate reality is the ground of what we call the global commons. So that the more that people can plug into this deeper spirituality, the more we will have an important resource in promoting our concern for the global commons. It just so happens that one of our conference participants and one of our core group leaders who will be with us in Italy is also here on the call today. Again, we've been with James Quilligan before on the call. So I wanted to say hello to you, James, and ask if there was anything you might want to add at this point about this very important concept.
Let me just, before you say anything, let me just say that nobody knows more about the global commons in terms of the shared resources of the human and planetary community than James, and he's going to be bringing that to our gathering in Rome and Florence. And hi, James.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Barbara and everyone. The commons is something I have specialized in. My background has been international development, and I've moved into this area of the commons for precisely the reasons that Paul Nitter was speaking about. And in brief, it is the things that we share, and unfortunately, in the cognitive framework that we live in today, we've divvied up the commons, and the commons are being regulated either by government or enclosed through private sector initiatives. And the commons is a means of reclaiming the things that belong to everyone. And I hope to share some of that perspective further in Italy.
Yeah, thank you.
I really like the way that Paul James puts a sort of borrows that term, the global commons, which has been very important in some of the internal dialogues of the Peace Council, borrows that term and brings it to the interreligious experience.
Yes,
I think
indeed.
It works really nicely.
Yes.
Okay.
Very good. So in the interest, there's so much more to say each one of these interviews, and I'm so glad that we're going to get to meet so many of the people that whose interviews we've been listening to over the weeks and discussing, that we could go on for a long time to discuss each of these concepts because they're just content-packed. But I think in the interest of time, we might move on a little bit to the Seshagiri Rao interview. And Jim, you also might introduce us a little bit to him and a little bit about your relationship over the years.
Yeah, well, Seshagiri Rao is another, just a remarkable, remarkable guy. He is a Gandhi scholar, a scholar of Hinduism and of Indian culture. He was for many years, he's a professor emeritus now, but he was at the University of South Carolina in Columbia. And while there, he initiated a project that he's still involved in, but that has been coming to fruition. And that is a multi-volume encyclopedia of Hinduism. It's just an incredible undertaking with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of scholars. Anyone that's ever tried to edit anything understands what it's like to. It's like, as people like to say, it's like herding cats to round up the contributions of brilliant people that know their field. Anyway, Seshagiri has done that, and the Encyclopedia of Hinduism is out. There are still some volumes that aren't released, but this is an amazing guy. Also, as I say, one of the most important voices on Mahatma Gandhi. And so it's interesting, in our interview, I read to him what we had said about the excellence of Hinduism, and it had to do with Hinduism being the religion that so powerfully speaks about the relationship between the human and the divine, and that presents the divine in all of its magnificent variation. And it brings together the atheist and the polytheist. And that was our emphasis on the human divine. And he said, that's all very nice and quite right, quite correct. But that he would really want to add a different excellence. And he says, it's not so much the knowledge that's important. It's the practice that's important. He said, you may know lots, I love this line, you may know lots of things about swimming, but if you don't get in the water, you don't know how to swim. Knowledge is not enough. 1 ounce of practice is better than 1 pound of theoretical knowledge, which I thought was great coming from a scholar, you know, just to say, well, okay, scholarship is really good, but it's understanding. And he's talking about the practice of prayer, meditation, and so on, but one other thing, and he then added this. He said, putting that truth in action is important. And he said, and that's what we call service or seva, again, S-E-V-A. And how do you put love and compassion in action? Because Hinduism speaks beautifully about love and compassion, as does Christianity, for example. But how do you put it into action? Well, you do it by serving other people. And he said, service to people is service to God. And Mahatma Gandhi called this sarvodaya. In modern day Hindi, you'd pronounce that sarvodaya. But sarvodaya, it's service to or giving to or the development of and welfare of all. Sarva, the all. So the development and welfare of the all. He went on to stress that real service demands that there be no discrimination whatsoever between race, between people on the basis of race or religion or nation. Since every person is equal to every other, you must serve all people. And when you serve others, you serve all aspects of their being, the physical, but also the mental and the intellectual and the spiritual. And I loved that he made those distinctions, the physical, the mental, the intellectual, and the spiritual. And he says is that what has happened in many cultures, in many countries, is that the emphasis has been almost exclusively on this physical aspect. We, to the extent that we serve others or recognize needs, we recognize only physical needs, and that kind of attitude, even if it begins with generosity, can pretty quickly deteriorate into just consumerism or materialism. And he says, if you forget that you have and that everyone has a spiritual dimension, then you forget about what's really worth achieving in life. So it all sort of sums up. Service is where it all comes together, not only the proper knowledge, but the proper way of putting that knowledge into practice. I thought it was a very powerful statement he made.
It was a very powerful interview in general. I think before I go on with a comment or two, I might ask again of the participants if there's any, if you're moved to ask a question or make any comment at this point. I saw that there was a hand up that Kay had a question before, but maybe she'll want to hold that to the end because it was about the former discussion. But I see that Ginger Charles had a question or a comment. Would you like to go ahead?
I was commenting earlier that it's interesting how the modules, I usually get some form of example in the weeks that follow before our conversation.
Oh. And, that's cool.
Yeah, it really is very cool. So I'll try and share this story very quickly. We had a little four-year-old boy that drowned in the pool, and so we had to have a meeting with the district attorney, all the district attorney, assistant district attorneys, the social workers, victim advocates, in order to determine whether or not we actually pursue a case against the grandmother who happened to be inattentive for 51 minutes. It only took, or 51 seconds. It only took 51 seconds for this little boy to drown. And so there was a lot of conversation around this about, you know, what is the true nature of the law, and what is the most benefit for the community and for the family? Are we going to fracture this community and this family by charging this grandmother for being inattentive for 51 seconds, or are we losing the larger picture of what is the lesson here about keeping your kids within arm's length? There were lots of tears because the video shows this little boy drowning, and it was so devastating to see how quickly and quietly this little boy died. But the message with all of them was, no, don't charge the grandmother. This is not criminal. This is a quick, brief accident that's horrific. The larger message is, how do we tell the community to keep your kids within arm's reach? So anyway, I thought that was a great service to community by many people. I know there were several spiritual traditions in that room working on a larger picture other than just what is the facts and what is the law. So that's all I was going to say.
Ginger, this is Jim. Hi.
Hi, Jim.
Thanks again. You always bring such wonderful insights. But for the people who don't know you and aren't familiar with what you do, can you just introduce yourself and put it in context? Because I think it would be important for people to know where you're coming from.
Oh, I apologize. I'm a police sergeant in a metro police agency in Colorado. Been one for 25 years, and for the last 10 years have been researching spirituality in police work. And so I guess I would consider myself a research practitioner, doing a lot of action research and observing a lot of this in action as, you know, as I progress in my career.
No, thank you for sharing that, because I think, once again, it exemplifies the point that we're making here and many of our interviews have made, that whether knowledge comes in the form of dialogue or theoretical understanding, that the evolution of spirituality is this very intentional or mindfulness, let's say, this mindfulness that in the roles we perform in our everyday life, if it's within our family, if we're teachers, whatever our profession leads us into, the circumstances that, such as the ones that Ginger just described, that bringing our spiritual principles into that context is not only a good idea, it's absolutely necessary at this time considering the challenges that we're facing. And the idea of having a component of spirituality in law enforcement is just mind-blowing to me. And yet, it should be present in every one of our social institutions. And I think, once again, that's something that we'll be talking about very deeply when we're in Rome and Florence together, because everyone has stories to tell and a way of describing the practicality of their lived spirituality in the context of what they're bringing to the world every day. That's actually what will shift the paradigm, is the demonstration by individual human beings of how they can behave and make different choices than the ones we're making now, because we can't change as a society without changing as individual actors within a social context. So, Ginger, every time you tell a story, I always feel so inspired, and I have a lot to say. So, is there more of that we want to talk about in this interview, or might we just now have a few more minutes to finish up by looking at the Global Manifesto, the document that we were studying this week? Is there anyone else who'd
maybe
like to make a comment or ask a question? Okay, good. Let's go on then. That's a good idea.
Well, this week's or this module's global declaration, global framework, let's call it, is the Millennium Development Goals that were promulgated in 2000 by the General Assembly at the prompting of Kofi Annan. And I often speak about these and am in discussion about these eight goals set forth by the United Nations. If you want to learn more about them, and I think it's really good to be in touch with these, because the UN does a pretty good job, I think, of reporting where we are with these various goals. And I'll tell you about that, but let me just tell you about the goals themselves. I think it's fair to say that this is an imperfect list of goals in many ways, and yet I, for one, am so grateful that this intergovernmental organization was able to put these on the table. And they are eight in number, the Millennium Development Goals. Originally, the idea was that these goals, we would be well on the way, halfway at least, on the way to achieving each of these goals by 2015. And in several regards, that was the case until the 2008 global financial meltdown, which, of course, has severely retarded the progress. But nevertheless, the work goes on. The first is to end poverty and hunger. The second, to accomplish universal education. The third, gender equality. I'm really tempted, and I'm going to yield to it, to say that most of the people that work in that field don't talk about gender equality, but rather gender equity, which is a slight semantic but very important semantic difference. So end poverty and hunger, universal education, gender equity, let's say, child health, maternal health, combating HIV and AIDS, working for environmental sustainability, and in a sense, one of the most inspired of them all is working to create the kinds of global partnerships that will make it possible to achieve these various goals. There's much more that could be said about these and several other goals, I think, that might well be inserted here. But I think if one believes, I'll just say this much, if one believes that ours is really a time of values change, not that things are all getting fixed or that everything is getting better, but that our values are shifting dramatically, rapidly in something like the right direction, then this is, to me, one of the critical pieces of evidence. And this has everything to do with social justice, human rights, and environmental sustainability, with peace, justice, and sustainability. And you're going to hear that PJS refrain, peace, justice, and sustainability, again and again through the conference. I started to say, if you wanted to track this, because I think the UN does a pretty good job of saying, where are we? Where did we hope to be, for example, with regard to ending poverty and hunger? Go to the UN website, which is easy to remember. It's just un.org. I always love entering the portals there of that website, because you have to choose the language you want, and the array of linguistic choices is dizzying and wonderful. And then once you're into the website, just search on the website for MDG, Millennium Development Goals, and an abundance of information. What are we doing? What's happening in different parts of the world? What did we hope would have happened by now, and what has not happened, and so on. Just one little example, at Cancun in July, the 20th anniversary, the second 10-year, reevaluation of the Rio de Janeiro Earth Summit from in 1992, one of the things that was discussed was that subset of the End Poverty and Hunger Development Goal that deals with providing clean water to the roughly half of the people on the planet that do not have access to clean water. The other aspect of the water situation is providing sanitation for people that don't have access to it. And while we have fallen far short of providing the sanitation, the clean water goal has nearly been met. So just one little tidbit. I'm sure we could, James Quilligan, if we had more time, could say a great deal about what's right and what's missing from the Millennium Development Goals, but he and I and all of us promise you that we'll be getting into that conversation. But this is something that everyone should know about. And people who think that nothing ever changes, familiarize them with this initiative, because I think it's a very important one.
And it is important. And when we first, with the help of our very capable assistant, Megan, decided to put this much material up on the website, it, in service of preparation for all of us for this conference, we did discuss the question, and many people asked it of us, what's really the purpose of all these declarations and manifestos and proclamations? Do they actually ever bring any practical value? And one of the reasons that we chose these particular 10 from the 20th century, actually, was to demonstrate a couple of things, one of which is that they actually have been seminal to making change and progress that's measurable in the face of sometimes that some of us feel that there is no hope and there is nothing that can be done and there is no quantifiable, measurable yardstick, so to speak, in order to look at goals that we set for ourselves as humanity and whether we're getting close to them or not. But secondly, the mistake I think that we make again and again, despite our best intentions, when we're especially gathered in groups, when we're studying in community, when we're attending conferences, is that we fail to prepare ourselves or make ourselves aware of the field of work that's been done with regard to the goals that we're discussing at that particular event or conference. In other words, we think that we have to begin a new discussion, that we actually lose out by not making ourselves aware of specifically what kind of work has been done and by whom and to what degree from other organizations and other initiatives in the past. So we're hoping that some of this reading will bring us closer to that cooperative goal of understanding in this conference. Jim, questions? Any? We're getting to the top of our hour, so I don't want to. I see that we have one question. I think Eve or a comment. Eve Constantine.
Yes. Can you hear me, Barbara?
Yes, we can.
Okay.
This is just a comment or a piece of information that there's a wonderful educational game for children, but it's great for adults too, that's been developed to teach about the MD, the Millennium Development Goals, and to educate people about what they are. All the facts all over the world culled from the UN data is what's in it, and you can play it with people, you know, anywhere in the world. It's just lots of fun, and I think that if you go on the UN website, you might be able to find it. And in concert with that, it's being developed by someone that you, some may know, Theo Cosmora, who developed the game, is also developing a platform which will, if one signs up for the platform, there's a free basis, but they're also for fee. The signing up will directly plug into, in part, supporting the MDGs. So it's just, just to let people know. But the game is up and running, and it's very educational and lots of fun, and it's almost addictive if you find it.
Yeah, I'm going to be going.
I didn't know anything about this, and I just quickly got online, and I just searched for MDG game, and I found it right away, the MDG Progress game. And so thanks so much for telling us about it. I didn't know.
You're welcome.
Wow, cool, another addiction. Yay! Thanks, Eve. Okay, well, any more comments or questions from anyone? Jim, did you have some wrap-up comments before we just announce the date of our next tutorial together and what that's about?
No, I'm pretty wrapped.
Oh, I know. It's the end of the day for many of us. Okay, well, thank you. The next study module is number 6, starting from now and ending in our next tutorial 2 weeks from now, which is August 23rd, Thursday at 5 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Topic is forgiveness in the Middle East, not an insignificant topic, I would say. We're going to be looking at the spiritual tradition of Baha'i. We'll be looking at audio interviews with Charles Nolly and also with Rabbi Levi Wyman Kelman, who's going to be with us in Italy. The manifesto that we're looking at next week is the Brundtland Report, and you know the rest of it, I think. Tomorrow is our Italian lesson at 1 p.m. Pacific. We might have to review because I, for one, don't remember almost anything from those first two lessons. So as many of you who can join us, please do. You're welcome. One more question, and then we'll head off. Reverend Michael, would you like to, do you have a comment or a question?
Yes, really quick. I'm wondering if there have been any plans to set up a collaboration site just so that we can get a better sense of, you know, our intentional community and, you know, and perhaps be able to connect. Our little dialogue that we had was just so very powerful, and, you know, and I'm really looking forward to expanding that connection with the circle.
Oh, I didn't really plant you there, but I'm glad that you asked this. Let me see. On our website, agnt.org/awakened2012,
mm-hmm.
If you go right back to the tutorial section that you go to when you look for your materials for tutorial every couple of weeks,
yeah.
If you scroll down beneath the big buttons there, you'll find something called a participant communication forum. We might need to put this somewhere on the menu that's a little more visible because it is kind of. Sorry, we'll work on this. We have a participant communication forum up and ready to go, and it'll allow you to talk to each other on conference themes. It'll allow you to meet the community that will be in attendance, also share your projects, and you can talk a little bit about travel and tourism in case you want to hook up with people to travel before or after. So that's the purpose of the forum, and we'll see what we can do to make the communication forum more immediately visible when you get to the website at agnt.org/awaken2012.
Wonderful.
Thank you for asking that. We hope that you'll use that now that we're getting closer to the event.
Yes.
Wow,
thank
talk
you.
About a good answer.
I was prepared for that one. We had an answer. Okay, well, thank you all. It's always a pleasure for us to get together, and it makes me even more excited about getting to meet you all face-to-face in Italy within another month and a half or less. So,
Okay, so we'll see you next time, and have a wonderful weekend. Thank you all. Good night.